verses that we'll be discussing this morning. We'll conclude a section. We have some guests with us. I've not been here for the other parts, so I'll just give you a little background. What we're discussing from First Canto Bhagavatam, chapter 7. And in this section, the author of Srimad Bhagavatam is Srila Vyasadeva. Not only he's the author of the Srimad Bhagavatam, but Vyasadeva is the compiler of all the Vedas. I'll give a synopsis. Going back to chapter 4 of this first canto of the Bhagavatam. So the first chapters are introducing what's the subject. And it's doing it in a very beautiful way. What's the subject of the Srimad Bhagavatam? Krishna is the subject of Srimad Bhagavatam. And in what way is Krishna being presented? The description is that the sages of Naimisharanya, there's a sacred place in India known as Naimisharanya, where according to Vedic calculation, just as the earth spins, the whole universe spins, moves on an axis, and that axis passes through the earth planet at Naimisharanya. And so, for that reason, it's a sacred place, and it's also understood that whatever sacrifice or yajna is performed at Naimisharanya, are we okay? Thank you. Whatever is performed at Naimisharanya, the benefit derived from that sacrifice goes to the whole universe. It's very special. The sages indicated that they wanted Kali Yuga had begun. The age that we're presently in, the age that follows Dwarka Yuga when Krishna was present, after Krishna departed, then the next age was beginning. In the next age, the sages knew, was filled with bad qualities and would get worse and worse and worse, just like a whirlpool. Down. So they wanted to do something. They wanted to perform a sacrifice that would be of benefit for the people of this age, who would, just by being born in this age, would be sucked into that vortex of decreasing quality of life, particularly spiritual quality of life. So they assembled the Naimisharanya. And as their assembly was getting underway, the son, one who had heard Srimad Bhagavatam being narrated, Suta Goswami, was requested, please describe that which you heard, the Srimad Bhagavatam which you heard, which was compiled by Vyasadeva, as the cream, the topmost portion of the whole Vedic literature. So he described the essence of that message. And then they asked the question, how did it appear? How did it come about that he compiled this very special literature? And so, in answer to that question, there's four chapters, or three and a half. Chapter 4, 5, 6, and the beginning part of chapter 7, which we're going to end this morning. So the question is, how did the Srimad Bhagavatam appear? And it appeared, the answer is given, Vyasadeva compiled all the Vedic literatures. Well, first, Vyasadeva was contemplating, because he's Sri Kalagya, he has the capacity to know things not only present, but in the future and in the past equally well. He's an all-knowing personality. So as he contemplated the future of this Kali Yuga, what he saw was so repulsive for a saintly person, he also wanted to do something. As the sages of Naimisharanya wanted to do something, he, as a literary person, wanted to do something. So he compiled the Vedas, which was one Veda, and divided it into four Vedas with supplementary literature that would explain those Vedas, make it very easily accessible to increasingly disqualified persons or unfortunate persons who just couldn't understand and derive the benefit of the Vedas. He made it easy. And then after doing all of that work, the four Vedas, the Puranas, Mahabharata, Vedanta Sutra that summarizes all that knowledge, he stepped back and contemplated how did it come out, and he was feeling very dissatisfied. He didn't know why he was feeling very dissatisfied, so he inquired from Narada, his spiritual master. And this little point I'm making right now, it connects with this morning's verses. I mean, like, perfect match. So Narada explained, while you have anything that you've written is not wrong, but you've given inordinate emphasis to how living entities can fulfill their material desires in a religious manner. That's good. They can learn how to fulfill their material desires in a religious manner, but that's not the ultimate purpose of the Veda. The ultimate purpose of the Veda is to know Krishna. Vedaishtasaya vairaham eva vedyo Vedanta krit veda vid eva chaham, Krishna declares in Bhagavad Gita. So you've not sufficiently... Your purpose was you were concerned about the misfortune of the living entities in Kali Yuga, but unfortunately you've encouraged them in the very thing that is their misfortune. That is, too much attraction for fulfilling material desires. So now they're doing it in a religious way by the result of your literature, the karma kanda portion of the literature, and even the jnana kanda portion of this literature, that which gives knowledge of Brahman. That's also not, it's nice, because it's truth, Brahman is truth, but the personality of Godhead is going to attract them from their material condition to the perfected spiritual condition. Compose such a literature. And to compose such a literature, you should completely fix yourself in absolute trance of meditation upon the personality of Godhead. That which you experience should be the subject matter of your literature. This other literature I want you to compose. Now, he had already written, when he compiled the Puranas, he compiled a synopsis of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And later, it's that same synopsis that he taught to Shukadeva Goswami. I'm going to read a little passage where Prabhupada explains that. So, skipping a whole chapter, Narada giving his personal previous life of how he also did the same, fixed his attention upon the personality of Godhead and saw the personality of Godhead in one lifetime, face to face, right before him, and continued to perfect his life in devotion. So Vyasa did like that. The verses that follow are beginning of chapter 7 are verses that describe what Vyasa's realization was. Vyasa's realization was he saw the personality of Godhead in his whole spiritual abode. He was on the bank of a river, sacred river, in India, physically, but his consciousness was so absorbed in the personality of God that he saw the whole spiritual world. The Lord disclosed that to him by his spiritual potency. He disclosed it to him. So he could see the Lord was the source of everything. Everything material and spiritual, and he saw the various expansions of the Lord, and the spiritual energies and the material energies, and he saw the marginal energy, the living entity, jiva, and how the jiva was conditioned by yaya sammohita jiva atmanam trigunatmakam, conditioned by the maya, the external energy of the Lord, so much so that he had lost his identity as a living entity, as a spirit soul, and thought himself a product of matter, like most people of the world today. Think themselves, the scientists certainly tell us, we're a product of matter. What is life? A combination of matter. We know the whole story, how it happens, once upon a time, with the primordial soup, and so on. Largely, it's a fact. People consider themselves, even if they have some notion of soul, you ask them who they are, and any answer they're going to give you is in terms of the body. My name is so-and-so, and well, tell me some more about yourself. Well, I was born in such and such place, and these were my parents, and I grew up here, and then I went to education there, and in terms of the body. You fill out any form. What does the form say? How, put your address, your telephone number, your height, your weight, your color of your eyes, and all types of nice things about the body. And that's who I am. Okay, that's who you are. Now I know who you are. We have you in our big data bank somewhere in Washington, D.C. Giant computer now knows who you are. Social Security number, passport number, Visa card number, driver's license number, and that's who you are. How you identify the person, thumbprint. The identity of the soul is lost. Vyasa saw that. The bewildering influence of the material energy conditioning the soul so that he completely forgets his real happiness. He completely forgets himself. He completely forgets the Supreme Lord from whom he has come. So he then also understood the mitigating process, way of slackening or reducing that influence. And that process was hearing spiritual sound vibration, hearing transcendental topics. But by hearing transcendental topics, based on that understanding, Vyas compiled the Srimad Bhagavatam. And where we ended up yesterday afternoon, we heard what happens, what subjectively what happens when one hears that message. When one hears that message, the natural affinity or attachment for the Supreme Lord awakens. And as that awakens, correspondingly as that awakens, then the shoka, moha, and bhaya, apaha, is destroyed. The lamentation illusion and fear that have a strong hold on conditioned souls. It's eliminated. Abaha. So after Vyas compiled the Bhagavatam, he then taught it to his son. Because as he had compiled the other portions of the Vedas, he had trusted them to principal disciples, that they would care for and preserve those portions. Each of the Vedas, each of the four Vedas, was entrusted to a particular very prominent disciple, and then they had their team, and their job, their assignment, their service was to learn thoroughly. One of the procedures for those who had the capacity to do so prior to Kali Yuga, and even those that disciplined themselves so to a degree they could in Kali Yuga. The Vedas were learned forwards and literally backwards, because you might make some mistake, just like you're checking a mathematical calculation. You might count your numbers this way, so you count your numbers this way to make sure you've got it, the right calculation. So they memorized forwards and memorized backwards, the whole team of them. So that if one kind of goofed, the others would, you know, preserve the right thing. So it would be just held in their memory. And they could, you know, they could cross-check. So that they, it was a serious service to be entrusted with learning a Veda. And Vyasadeva selected his own son, Shukadeva, to be entrusted with Srimad Bhagavatam, and it wasn't just family affection or nepotism. It was the qualification of Shukadeva Goswami, because he's so qualified, even more than any of his other disciples. In fact, so qualified that when Shukadeva Goswami entered the assembly, when Maharaj Parikshit was about to die, and he gathered all the sages of his kingdom, which was the whole world, to come and participate with him in that event of his departure, all those sages, when Shukadeva Goswami entered their assembly, they immediately stood out of respect for this 16-year-old boy that just showed up because of his spiritual qualification. So Vyas also entrusted Shukadeva Goswami with the Srimad Bhagavatam. Now the sages that are hearing this explanation, their question was, how did the Bhagavatam appear? So they're getting an explanation of how it appeared. Then they stop the narrator, Sutta, and they say, wait. Shukadeva Goswami is a liberated soul. Why is a liberated soul learning something? He's already liberated. He doesn't need some knowledge to, like, make himself more complete. Why did he study? And that question prompts three verses. One of those verses, we spent extensive time yesterday discussing the Atmaram verse, and it's the importance of the Atmaram verse in Vedic picture. Because the word Atmaram, Atmaram, one who derives Ram, one who derives pleasure, on the platform of the soul, they're self-satisfied. They don't need anything outside of themselves. So the verse says that even those who are Atmaramas find great happiness in the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam, meaning the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam are not material. Otherwise they wouldn't derive any happiness. But they derive great happiness from the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam. And then it describes why. Atmaramas chamunayo nir grantha api urukrame kurvanti ahaitukim bhaktim. We discussed this. This is a little review for those of you who were with us yesterday. Kurvanti ahaitukim bhaktim. Kurvanti means to do something for the benefit of others, for the pleasure of others, as opposed to material activity, which is I want and I do something to fulfill what I want, called fruitive activity or karma. So different than karma is kurvanti. You do something not for yourself but out of bhava or for the benefit of others. And to emphasize that point, ahaitukim. Hetu means there's a cause, like as in material events, there's cause and effect, like the laws of physics. Cause and effect. So, with spiritual activity, there's no cause. And so there's no effect. No material cause, and there's no material effect. Because if it's transcendental, it's on the spiritual platform. There are spiritual activities that have no cause. No material cause. But what there's a cause. That's attraction for Krishna, or kurvanti, doing something for another. For the other is urukrame, arukrama. So I don't want to re-give the whole class from yesterday, but just to summarize, the one of the two names of the Lord in this verse is Urukrama, meaning he who is the performer of very wonderful activity. So even his material activity, even the act of creation is very wonderful. In so many ways, with the product is very wonderful, and how you can't even detect or perceive the Creator. Like, unless you're spiritually qualified. But it's so amazing. The creation is so amazing that so many people think there's not even a Creator. So, Prabhupada gave an explanation once I found to be fascinating. He described that even with something of this world, like architecture, behind the architecture, there's an architect. Like, you know, Jeffersonian style is of architecture or design of residences or buildings is, I'm not an architect, so I may be using the wrong language, but is prominent here in this part of the country. That when houses have these, or buildings have these, the door, and in front of the door is big columns, and a little canopy over those big columns, and it's a certain style of architecture. And behind the architecture, there's an architect, there's a person. And so the stamp of a certain architect's style is shown through something that lives after them, the architecture. So Prabhupada is extending logically, therefore one can understand. As you see how the products of creation are there, there's a stamp of the uniqueness of so many things, the forms of life, the species of life, the variety of life, the stamp of that, the person from whom all of this has come. So we don't see the person. we see the architecture they left behind, the creation that they've left behind. Or, you know, some artist, Jackson Pollock, or some, you know, crazy person who painted canvases and became famous. Art. We were going for a morning walk once with Srila Prabhupada in Central Park in New York. And the east side of Central Park, above 72nd Street, there's this pond, a small lake. And that small lake, it's the children's play area, so they allow them to put boats on the, you know, little sailboats and little toy motor boats, and kids go there, and they have all around, there's famous storyteller authors that have their statues, Hans Christian Andersen, and this one and that one. And this, that was the walking area. So we walked around a couple times, and then Prabhupada pointed with his cane. He wanted to see what was north in the park, so we took a little path and followed the path. And it comes out right before the Metropolitan Museum of Art. But just before you get to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, it's kind of like in a forested area along a trail. And all of a sudden it was a clearing. Off in the distance is the Museum of Art. And just before that is this sculpture. Sculpture of a piece of steel that was twisted and misshapen and grotesque. And a big sculpture. Prabhupada stopped, looked at the thing. Big, you know, one of those big sculptures. Raised his cane and pointed and said, "This is the mind of the modern artist." And they call this art. That was enough. He turned around and wanted to go back to the children's area. Back to the lake. So, a creation tells something about the creator. The writing tells something about the author. Vyasadeva's writing tells something about him. The Vedas already existed. The Vedas are emanations of Narayan, directly the breathing of Lord Narayan. So it tells us something about Lord Narayan, his compassion for the living entities who wish to try to be separate from him, to come. That's what this material world is created for those who wish to be separate. And so he creates this appearance of separateness, although there is no separateness. And that's what maya means. Ma-ya, not this. It appears to be what it isn't. It's only a reflection of that which is. So, those who are captured by Maya, they get relief from Maya by hearing the topics of Bhagavatam. That's where we ended. No, we ended with the Srimad, but the Atmarama verses, not only worldly people, but transcendental personalities. On the stage of perfection, already having attained perfection, such persons are attracted because the topics of Urukrama attract even them. It gives them great pleasure to hear the glories of Arukrama, or to speak the glories of Arukrama, or to be in that transcendental vibration. Itam Bhuta Guno Hari. So, Hari indicates one who takes away. Hari means one who takes away. When the Supreme Lord takes away that which is inauspicious, he puts in its place that which is auspicious. And because the conditioned soul has inauspicious, Hari takes away inauspicious, and that which is auspicious is already there within the soul, but he attracts that which is auspicious to awaken within the heart. And that's the nature of Krishna Katha, or this message of the Bhagavatam. So now, this morning we have just two verses. Text 11 and 12 in chapter 7. Sutta is still narrating. He says, Srila Shukadeva Goswami, the son of Srila Vyasadeva, was not only transcendentally powerful, he was also very dear to the devotees of the Lord. Thus he underwent the study of this great narration, Srimad Bhagavatam. So the question was, why? The answer was given, well, he's an Atmarama, and Atmaramas that have no material attraction, they are attracted to spiritual attraction, they're attracted to topics of transcendence. So it's not he did it because he needed something. He did it because he wanted to do, to give something. He wanted to give happiness to Urukrama by hearing topics about him. And thereby he was driving great happiness. So now he's saying, the sutta is saying, not only he was transcendentally powerful like this, he was Atmarama, but moreover, he was also very dear to the devotees of the Lord. So this is a separate reason. And the purport discusses very nicely this separate reason. First, I want to read Prabhupada's summarizing the sequence of these events, of the narration of Srimad Bhagavatam. According to Brahma Vaivarta Purana, Shukadeva Goswami was a liberated soul even within the womb of his mother. Srila Vyasadeva knew that the child after his birth would not stay at home. How did Vyasadeva know that? He's Trikalagya. Even before the child was born, he knew what would happen after the birth of the child. Knowing that, while the child was within the womb, he impressed upon him the synopsis of the Bhagavatam so that the child could be made attached to the transcendental activities of the Lord. The synopsis of the Bhagavatam was the Chaturshloki verses of the Bhagavatam, which are in Canto 2. So while within the womb, Shukadeva Goswami heard. Then Shukadeva Goswami left. After his birth, the child was still more educated in the subject of the Bhagavatam by recitation of the actual poems. So we discussed this yesterday. He left home. Vyasadeva, by clever arrangements, attracted him to come back home by having one brahmana in disguise of a hunter go into the forest, find Shukadeva, speak the Bhagavatam, because Shukadeva Goswami was so attracted to the Bhagavatam. Please tell more. I will tell more, but you have to come with me. He brought him back to Vyasadeva, and Vyasadeva instructed the entirety of the Bhagavatam. That's some chronology. Then the rest of the purport Prabhupada discusses something that either we internally have to undergo, or those who were in the company of may be undergoing, or new persons that we contact, and as we're sharing Krishna consciousness with them, we find that there's this concern. There's a concern that some persons have of an attraction for an impersonal conception, because they've heard it, they've read books about it, they've been exposed to it in some way. Language says it's all one and those kinds of things. And so how does that fit in with Bhagavatam in a life of devotion to the personal feature of the Supreme? Even a whole chapter of, well, chapter 12 of Bhagavad Gita has this question as its introduction. Even Arjuna is asking Krishna, which do you consider to be more perfect, worship of your personal feature or worship of your impersonal feature? So that's being addressed in this part of the purport. Prabhupada writes, the idea is that generally liberated souls are attached to the feature of impersonal Brahman, with a monistic view of becoming one with the Supreme Whole. But by the association of pure devotees, like Vyasadeva, even the liberated soul becomes attracted to the transcendental qualities of the Lord. That's the Atmarambras. Even liberated souls become attracted to the transcendental qualities of the Lord. The Kumaras, we mentioned that yesterday also, they're Kumaras. They were Brahman realized. And when they came to the gates of Vaikuntha, and they smelled the fragrance of the tulsi buds and the sandalwood anointing the lotus feet of the Lord, they became attracted. They're not attracted to anything material. They're liberated souls. But they became attracted to the qualities of the Lord. And thereby they became devotees. That's what devotee means. It's the same Advaya Gyan, knowledge of non-dual realm, but where there's variegatedness within the non-dual realm. There's qualities, there's form, there's personality, there's activity in the transcendental realm. So that's news for somebody who has been grown up or raised with the spiritual understanding of becoming one with the Supreme. I had this experience once. I was at the University of Texas in Austin with some I was exploring the possibility of establishing some kind of foothold of a preaching center there for the devotees in Texas. So I'd spent about 10 days with a very large display of books, like 2 6-foot tables right in front of the student center. It was really fantastic. Because everybody, the system there is, they have to, the mail, if you're a student at UT, you get your mail at the student center. And it doesn't get delivered to your dormitory. It gets delivered to the student center. So everybody has to go through the student center. So I was right in front of the student center, meeting everybody. It was very nice. And it was nice, nice big shade tree. It was really great. All day long meeting so many students. So in the course of doing that, I met some students from South India. They all knew each other, and they said, oh, why don't you come and visit our home? We'd like to have you speak something. So on the car ride, we were discussing, I can't remember the detail of the discussion, but it was just discussing topics. And as we were discussing topics, they said something very unusual. They said, oh, it sounds like what you're speaking about is God has form. We've heard about that. We've never met anybody that actually believed that. Would you like to talk about that when you have your program at our home? I said, sure, I'd like to talk about that. But I know, and as you're surprised that here, look at, there's a monarch butterfly with little pink things on his wings, like it's like a specimen to be examined by a botanist. Because they'd never seen a monarch butterfly before. They wanted to check me out. Magnification. I said, I've similarly never met anybody that never met anybody that even knew how to explain about Bhagavan. And they only knew about Brahman. I've certainly met people that know about Brahman, but never heard a actual description of Bhagavan. I mean, it's right in Bhagavad Gita. But then Bhagavad Gita can be rendered in such a way Bhagavan disappears, although it's Sri Bhagavan Uvacha. It just becomes Brahman by interpretation. When Krishna says, surrender unto me, the interpretation is, don't surrender unto Krishna, surrender unto the unborn within Krishna. Although, it doesn't say that. It says, surrender unto me. That's first person, singular, not unto third person, neuter. Him, or it. Anyway. The message that we're going to get is that by association with one who is attached to Bhagavan, one can, or one who is experienced, as Vyas was experienced in Bhagavan, he had seen Bhagavan, he had and compiled the Bhagavatam. Then Shukadeva Goswami became attracted. By the mercy of Vyasadeva, Shukadeva Goswami is able to grasp the import. The transcendental qualities of the Lord are so attractive that Shukadeva Goswami became detached from being completely absorbed in impersonal Brahman and positively took up the personal activity of the Lord. Practically, he was thrown from the impersonal conception of the Absolute, thinking within himself that he had simply wasted so much time in devoting himself to the impersonal feature of the Lord. Or in other words, he realized more transcendental bliss with the personal feature than the impersonal. Then, within the text 11, the phrase is there, Vishnu Jana Priya, Nityam Vishnu Jana Priya, Vishnu Jana, can be translated as a devotee of the Lord, Vishnu Jana, so a person of Vishnu. He became Priya, he became very dear to the devotees. He became very dear to the devotees. And likewise, the devotees became very dear to him. And because he had that quality, Vishnu Jana Priya, Sutta is saying he underwent this study. Because when you're dear to the devotees and the devotees are dear to you, there's something that you share, and that's the Lord. And so with the devotee, Vyas, he wanted to share topics of the Lord, and so he underwent the study because of this Vishnu Jana Priya quality. And how does one become Vishnu Jana Priya? How does one become dear to the devotees? By associating with one who is Vishnu Jana. By associating with Vyas. And Prabhupada comments, even Vyasadeva. How did it happen for Vyasadeva? Because Vyasadeva also was vastly learned and knowledge of Brahman. And when he compiled the Vedas first time around, very amply, very nicely, Brahman conception is found within the Vedas. It's for that reason that there are many persons who are Brahmavadis. They believe it's everything is Brahman. That's the absolute truth. Everything is Brahman. And they'll speak about it till the cows come home. They're very happy to talk about Brahman. So, if there's the Karmakanda section of the Vedas and the Gyanakanda section of the Vedas, which speak about fruitive activities and Brahman, how does one become Vishnu Janapriya? By associating with one who has that. So, Vyas had that strength, but through the association of Narada, he became realized in Bhagavan fully, and wrote Bhagavad Purana in its fullness. So it's not that the language that I just used is there's this evolving of Vyasa's realization. More exactly, it's induced by the Supreme Lord that he would be in that position for sake of compiling Bhagavatam in this way, and then Sukadeva Goswami speaking it to the Lord. So, not that Vyasa is some limited, conditioned being that's evolving, but it's the language is like that because of the way the unfolding of the pastime that the Lord arranged. So Prabhupada writes, thus both the son, Shukadev, and the father, Vyasadev, were completely cognizant of transcendental knowledge of Brahman, and afterwards, after associating with Vishnu Janapriya, both of them became absorbed in the personal feature of the Supreme Lord. Thus the question of how Shukadev Goswami was attracted by the narration of Bhagavatam is completely answered. There's two parts. He's Atmarama, transcendentally situated, and so are the topics of the Lord, and for that reason we can understand he was attracted. It wasn't to fulfill something that was lacking in him, but Kurvanti Ayatakim Bhaktim. And the other is, he was Vishnu Janapriya, that is made possible by the association of Vishnu Jana, devotees of the Lord. He became very dear to them, they became very dear to him, and the topics of the Lord are dear to both. And therefore, he underwent the study of this great narration. And the second verse is concluding. Sutta Goswami says, now I shall begin the transcendental narration of Lord Sri Krishna. Because what is the Srimad Bhagavatam? It's topics of Lord Sri Krishna. So now I'm going to narrate to you that which Vyasadeva wrote and taught to Shukadeva, and Shukadeva Goswami spoke it, and I heard it, and next time around, third edition, I'm going to present it to you. Topics of the birth, activities, and deliverance of King Parikshit. Wait a minute. This is supposed to be Krishna Katha, and you're going to talk about the history of some king. I've been to history class before. I want to hear about Krishna. So Prabhupada explains in the purport that topics about the devotees of the Lord is topics of Krishna, because the devotees of the Lord are packed up. They're intimately connected with the Lord. And so topics of the devotees of the Lord are topics of the Lord, pure devotees. And conversely, topic of the Lord includes topics of the pure devotees of the Lord. He explains that there are narrators of the Bhagavatam that say, Bhagavad Gita is not so important. The other cantos of the Bhagavatam are not as important as the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, because that's Krishna Katha. And of the Krishna Katha, those chapters about Rasa Leela, let's just go right there. Prabhupada doesn't have kind things to say about that mentality. Rather, the Bhagavatam is the entire 12 cantos. And each of those 12 cantos is as transcendental as the other 11. It's as if saying, you don't need your hand. You don't need your arm. You don't need your leg. You don't need your belly, you just need a head. The transcendental body of the Lord is fully transcendental, and so the literature, which is his literary incarnation, is fully transcendental, and one part is as transcendental as the other part. The body of the Lord is not to be thought of that way, and the Bhagavatam is not to be thought of that way. Rather, the subject matters are very expertly composed by Vyas so that it helps to qualify one to directly hear the topics of the Lord, the topics of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan, for example. By approaching the lotus feet of the Lord, one is gradually prepared to approach the other parts of the body of the Lord, just like this example of approaching the deity. In the second canto, it describes that one should approach darshan of the deity formed of the Lord by darshan of the lotus feet, and then the legs, and then the waist, and the chest, and the broad shoulders, and the beautiful face of the deity. And just as in the procedures of deity worship, that's how one is to do. One approaches the feet of the deity first, and says certain prayers, and so on. So the Bhagavatam is the literary deity, a literary form of the Lord, and one should approach in that manner also. No one should try to go to the matters of the 10th canto without having thoroughly understood the purport of the other 9 cantos. Krishna and his pure devotees like the Pandavas are on the same plane, and Krishna is not without his devotees. Of all the rasas, and the pure devotees like the Pandavas are not without Krishna. Mentioned already. Pandavas are always with Krishna. Wherever Krishna goes, the Pandavas go. And wherever the Pandavas go, Krishna goes. They're never separated. The topics about the Pandavas, or in this case, topics of the grandson of the Pandavas, Maharaj Parikshit, is Krishna Katha. The sages had asked, please tell us Krishna Katha. So now he's doing it. This is the second thing that they had asked in chapter 4. Please describe those topics which you have heard. So now he's going to do. So this is the point. All cantos of the Bhagavatam are equally important. All cantos of the Bhagavatam are Krishna Katha. Even that which prepares us to properly hear Krishna Katha is Krishna Katha. And then the direct, this is it. Krishna is appearing in the Bhagavatam in Canto 1, Chapter 7, in the form of his interactions with the Pandavas and the this question, the deliverance of King Parikshit, this is the whole Bhagavatam, but in this first canto, the scene is set later. There's like 4 chapters describing the qualifications of Maharaj Parikshit, and then there's a chapter describing the qualifications of Shukadeva Goswami, because the persons who are taking up the Srimad Bhagavatam, we need to know what are we have to do? What qualifications do we need to bring to the table to get the full benefit of the Bhagavatam? So qualifications like Maharaj Pariksit's qualifications are something we should carefully study. Not meant to imitate, but meant to learn from his example. This is what we as an audience, a receiver of the Bhagavatam, need to do. And then the qualifications of Shukadeva Goswami, which are unparalleled. But the principle of those qualifications, before speaking the Bhagavatam, one must become accomplished. So those understandings are presented in this first canto. Okay, any discussion or questions? Yes?
This is not a very simple question to what you were saying. All cantos are as important as the 10th canto. There are these portions of cosmology. And I used to always think, what does that have to do with any sort of devotion or something? In the sense that, even if you skip it, how much does it really matter, the distance between planets and all these sorts of things?
You're making a statement. And your question is, what is their importance?
Yeah, I'm asking, like, even if you skip it, how would that make a difference?
What if we cut off your hand? What would it make a difference? You could still function. What if we cut off a leg? Put you in a wheelchair, maybe put a stump on there instead of a leg. It's part of the body of the Lord. The transcendental body of the... So there's rules within the composition of Vedic literature. We'll go to the Rig Veda. In the Purusha Supta prayers, they're from Rig Veda. And in the Rig Veda, it's describing creation. But why do we need creation? Why do we even need the information about creation? It's in the Rig Veda. And then it's expanded in Canto 2, Srimad Bhagavatam. Purusha Sukta confirmed. It's explaining, expanding, or giving commentary on and upholding the principles of the creation. So why is it there? It's one of the rules of the Puranas is that there's Upa Puranas, there's Puranas, and there's Mahapuranas. And in the Mahapuranas, one of the topics, there's 10 topics, and one of the topics is Poshanam, the maintenance of the universe. So how everything is structured is one of the topics that the Mahapuranas must present. Because, the detail of how many yojanas between this planet and that planet is not going to take you back to Godhead or prevent you from going to go back to Godhead. But it's part of Veda, part of knowledge. Because knowledge means knowledge of everything. And the essential part is this. Everything comes from the Supreme. Now, in the academic community, the creationists have moved about in the university circuit amongst educated scholars saying fundamental creationism per the Old Testament in 7 days. And, you know, they're fundamentalists, and they get beat up by the academics. You know, mindless belief. What is the support from empiric evidence of this mindless belief? Rubbish. And you know, I'm shortening a big fight. So, then now I'm a theist. Now, why should I be a theist? On what basis should I be a theist? What we're dealing with so much is the world around us, like the material energy. So I have this idea that material energy is an emanation from the Supreme. Well, that's a nice idea. What evidence is there for that besides the scripture says so? Like God created heaven and earth in 7 days. Where's the evidence? Are you basing your belief just upon my scripture says so? Or is there other kinds of evidence upon which you're basing your convictions? So the whole unfolding, not only God created, but here's how he does it in detail and detail and detail, and even there's measurements of things, of time and space. And here's how it happens. Even we weren't around. We weren't around when Big Bang happened either. Whatever, you know, that the theory of how everything comes into being. Here's the Vedic model, how everything comes into being. And look at this. There's all these, so an examining personality that says, well, wait a minute. How accurate is this? It's accurate. It's amazingly accurate. So that's like, why is it useful for us? That's why it's useful for us. It's there because it's enjoined. It must be there. It's one of the things the Lord does. He creates. So Shristi and Stiti, Pralaya. Okay, that's nice. He creates and he maintains and he annihilates. How does that happen? Then it expands the subject. This is how it happens. This is when it's expanded. This is how it's situated. It's to help, so in short, it can be helpful to the empiricist who has doubt about the validity of this text. Should I accept it or not? Now, if we don't know all those, your question is, if we don't know that section, does it bar us from going back to Godhead? No. But it's important for us to go through it carefully because Vyasadeva put it there for a reason. We should have no doubt in some corner of our mind somewhere that everything comes from the Supreme. Because we're in an atmosphere that says something else. And those that say everything comes from the Supreme, it's largely, it's faith, but faith that's not supported by knowledge is shakable. It's flimsy. So this is faith that's supported by knowledge. Go back to where it started from. It's Veda, it's knowledge. It's important. One could ask the same question about not just the configuration of planets once they're constructed. What about how the whole thing unfolds and how the whole thing is wound up again? It's very technical. Do I need all that technical stuff to go back to Godhead? No. But if you look at it very, very, it's reason, it's there, you look at it very carefully, it's amazing. It's, the Lord is amazing. say many things more than that, but that's enough. One of the arguments of the evolutionists is that looking at the embryos of different species of life, it seems in the development stages of the embryos of those different species of life, they're very similar. So they take it that gives strength to the argument we come from some primordial ancestor. And the theist looks at that and says, gee, if I was going to design something, I wouldn't want to have to reinvent everything every time. It just, if there's some starting template, and then you adjust some things as you go along. That's it. That would be a very practical way to. It doesn't dismiss the design of creation. And lead therefore to evolutionary theory. Things don't come from a design, they come from evolving of systems into more complex systems. So then you have this, just like Prabhupada is describing here, you have this endless struggle. I didn't read that part. I'll read it. The devotees of the Lord who do not wish to kill the individuality of the living entities and who desire to become personal servitors of the Lord do not very much like the impersonalists. And similarly, the impersonalists who desire to become one with the Supreme are unable to evaluate the devotees of the Lord. Thus, from time immemorial, these two transcendental pilgrims have sometimes been competitors. Just like, you know, the theist and the atheist, Sura and Asura. The impersonalist, the impersonalist is also, there's two camps that seem to, you know, compete. So if we're going to be qualified theists, let us have a clear understanding of how it is. Aham Sarvasya Prabhavo. Let us take the time and trouble to clearly understand and express it. Therefore it's there. Because otherwise the challenge is either an impersonal challenge or an atheist challenge. Everything comes from matter. Or everything comes from Brahman. Impersonally. So in this literature that expounds personalism, there's all this detailed empiric information. There's a reason why it's there. And you will find, or anyone will find, as you go more deeply and more deeply and more deeply, just like there's Rabindra Srupa, who is heading a group of devotees who are, you know, like very dedicated team of devotees who are studying that section of the fifth canto. And they're spending a few years dividing up subjects within that fifth canto to go very deeply into this, into clearly understanding what it says. And guess what's at the other end? Personality of Godhead. That's what happens when you deeply go into the subject matter of Srimad Bhagavatam. You don't just get empiric information and, oh boy, I don't, you know, this is a waste of time. I don't need it. Follow the thread, and on the other side of the thread is the person. personality of Godhead.
How wonderful he
is the outcome.
And therefore I should serve him.
Anything else?
I wanted to verify an understanding. Can I ask you about that?
Yeah, go ahead.
Maharaj, you were talking about why did Shukdev Goswami actually take up to the study of Srimad Bhagavatam, and you gave two reasons. You said first is he's a liberated soul and he's attracted to topics of Guru Krama, basically. And the second point you said is he's Vishnu Janapriya. So he's dear to the devotees. I was thinking of this in, and then the second example you gave of similar kind of thing was that of Vyasdev, where you said that he's a very scholarly person and then he's also Vishnu Janapriya.
He became through the association of Narada.
Narada.
He's in the Leela.
I mean, what I was thinking of was from the perspective of how Prabhupada, he describes religion as being both philosophy as well as sentiment. It's not just one thing. So, is my understanding correct when I think of relationship as being the sentiment part and the philosophy being the study of the Vedas?
That's a college question again.
No,
nothing at all like that. Because relationship itself is both feeling and knowledge. Knowledge of the person and feelings of other. The more we understand the person, Krishna, the more love will be there. The more love is there, that will help disclose more about the person. Everything is in the relationship. Something else? Yes.
This might be off topic of what you were specifically saying, but can you address how one finds happiness?
How one finds happiness. Well, it's on topic because the Atmaram is finding happiness within, finding happiness within the soul, specifically. Rama means pleasure. Atma means soul. Atmarama means one who's finding pleasure in the soul. Finding happiness is at the soul level, not the sense and mind level. Finding real happiness is in fact the topic of these first seven chapters of the Bhagavatam. The phrase that's used again and again like a refrain is Atma Suprasana. Prasana. Prasana means happiness. And Suprasana means complete happiness. Atmasam. So, the author Vyasadeva is indicating again and again and again how that Atma Suprasana is reached. It's something that's already there, but covered, and it's uncovered by the process of, well, say it either one of two ways, by receiving spiritual sounds that resonate and awaken the soul, because the spiritual sounds and the soul are of the same quality. That sound resonates and awakens the soul, which is now covered or in a dormant state of consciousness. The happiness within is awakened by receiving transcendental sound. That's the Vedic process. Real happiness is reached by transcendental sound. There's all kinds of other sounds today. So many other sounds. So, marvel at how many sounds they can, you know, like the sounds when you're logging in and dial-up networking. Where does that sound come from? Or the sound of rap music, or the sound of, last night we were in a, like a semi-forested area, and there was so many crickets, so many sounds. But those don't awaken happiness of the soul. There's material goodness happiness, the sounds of the wind blowing through the trees, and the sounds, the net sounds of nature. That's conducive to quality of happiness and goodness, and others in passion and others in ignorance. But Atma Suprasana comes from transcendental sound. That's one answer. Another answer is embedded right within this Vishnu Janapriya term. Even one can go beyond material happiness to spiritual happiness, where the happiness of Brahman, the happiness of no longer the attraction and repulsion, the pushing and pulling, the duality of material existence, come to the level of Brahman, spiritual existence. Even within that position, where Shukadeva Goswami was and where Vyasadeva was, by the association of devotees, or Vishnu Jana Priya, Vishnu means the Lord, Jana means a person, Vishnu Jana, a person of the Lord, a devotee of the Lord, Vishnu Janapriya, one who is dear to, beloved of Vishnu Jana, the devotee of the Lord. By association with such persons, another kind of happiness, the happiness of a relationship with the Supreme Person, not just happiness of neutrality, a cessation of harassment, of the material duality, but positive spiritual happiness of attraction for the person, the personal features of the Supreme. That awakening comes through the association of Vishnu Janapriya, such persons who are thus situated. That quality of inner happiness is awakened, it's dormant, it's awakened by association with those who have similarly received it, who have had that awakened. Like a spark can ignite a fire. There's dry leaves over there, and a nice pile of dry leaves, and it just sits there. But if a spark from a fire lands on those dry leaves, then it becomes fire. The fire potential is there, dormant. A spark is all it takes, and you got a fire. So by the association of those who have such happiness of Bhagavan, the relationship with the personality of Godhead, who had that awakened in them by a similar association, that happiness can awaken in us. And otherwise, the happiness that we may find is going to be in the modes of nature. Mode of goodness happiness, a mode of passion happiness, or a mode of ignorance happiness. By default. Because happiness is, it's our nature. So we're looking for it. We don't look for misery, we look for happiness, because it's our nature. So if we don't, so we need association of those who have that happiness awakened in them. And ultimately it means that's the channel through which we can contact the Supreme. Because that's really what the happiness is. It's the happiness of the soul in a loving relationship with the Supreme. Yeah?
So, this happiness is almost the book of wisdom.
Yeah?
It's permanent. The mind and the heart. The heart is not.
Exactly. It's an alignment. And even the senses, the body, can experience there's the happiness of being relieved from being harassed by the animalistic urges, anger, fear, lust, greed, driven by those urges. That also, it's those become mitigated or reduced or eliminated. But then, again, the positive is that the senses, when properly engaged, can be instruments to serve the Supreme. And that's the greatest happiness, when the alignment is right. The body, the mind, the intellect, the soul, all aligned with the Supreme Person. It's fullness of happiness. But it has to come to the soul level for it to be complete, even on the mind and the gross physical level. We're okay? Yes?
So in this section, says that Sukadeva Goswami was thrown off in the impossible conception after
association
of Vyasa, or after hearing Srimad Bhagavatam.
Yes.
So I was just wondering that, like, when he leaves home as soon as he was born, like, what was he so attracted to? Like, it was not personal conception.
It wasn't, it's a good question, but it's not that he was attracted to something, he was just detached from anything. So there was, it was ahetu. There wasn't, he left for some reason. He just, there was no attachment. It's just like, you know, a kite flying in the wind or something. Just, what's the reason? It's not a will, it's just moved by the movements of the air or whatever the material forces are. And he wasn't attached to anything. But his father wanted him to become. But the seed, the synopsis of the Bhagavatam, had been instructed, so there was something positive. A little bit like, not the same, but a little bit like Narada in his previous life, searching for the Supreme. Following the practice that the sages had given him. And then he saw Vishnu in a trance of meditation. So, I'll say the same thing in a different way. For there to be clarity, there has to be very evolved state of consciousness. Like us, what clarity we have about the goal. We've heard about the goal thousands and thousands and thousands of times, but the clarity isn't there because our consciousness is not so evolved. But as consciousness evolves, there's greater clarity and there's greater sense of purpose because of that greater clarity. So, in the immature stage of devotion, there's this conceptual, theoretical acceptance of the goal, and the strong motivator is, I don't like this realm of duality. It really is not appealing to me. So it's aversion. More than it is strong attraction. But as we follow that path, as purification comes about, as going back to the question we just heard, when the
natural happiness of the soul awakens. That's what's discussed in the verse that we read the other day. Find the verse. Yeah. Bhaktir utpadyate pungsam, as the feelings of devotion awaken within the heart through this process of hearing, like the spark lands on the dry leaves and a little flame starts to come. It may not be at a mature stage, but when there's a little awakening of feeling and attraction for the Lord, that's so much more powerful than our aversion for what we, the duality we don't like. And that's where our attention should go, like very carefully giving oxygen to that little fire. Like fanning a little flame so it can grow. So, you certainly have to be very careful speaking about, you know, what Sukadeva Goswami was experiencing, because, you know, we're nobody and he's Sukadeva Goswami. But in the unfolding of this pastime, some synopsis he had heard, neutrality was there. He was attracted to that synopsis, so he wasn't propelled by something he didn't have, and he wanted something he didn't have, other than searching for the Lord. How to?
The practice of absorption without speculation.
That's your topic, how to? Well, wasn't this one questioned yesterday? I gave some options like lobotomy and electroshock therapy, burn out parts of the brain so that you don't, the brain doesn't think anymore. The electrochemical firing of the synapses doesn't happen because the whole system is shut down. That's an option. But better option is you recognize, how do you deal with anything we have our material dependencies, we have material conditionings, and we are so accustomed, we're so habituated to those material conditionings that even we may know they're unwholesome, they're detrimental, we keep doing them because they're part of our conditioning. You're coming to the Japa retreat. So one of the topics, preparing ourselves for the retreat is on this topic. It's one of the reasons for doing such a thing is to make a strong effort to leave behind our patterns of the comfort zone patterns, the conditioned patterns. You get a breakthrough. So there has to be some willingness to let go of those conditionings of speculating on everything. So instead, it's anukoyasya sankalpa pratikoyasya varjanam. Accepting that which is favorable and rejecting that which is unfavorable. So it's a cultivation of that. The more you can accept that which is favorable, you can let go of that which is unfavorable. So understanding things through a different channel than speculating about it. Understanding things by simply letting it touch your heart. So that requires some trust and faith. And some willingness to let go of a mental processor. Everything's got to pass through the secretary, the mind, before it can see the boss. And then the boss only gets the information that comes from the secretary. That's all the boss knows, what the secretary says, because everything has to go through the secretary. And the boss, the secretary becomes the boss.
So, for the intelligence to direct the mind, the positive approach.
A real intelligence is to recognize we don't have sufficient intelligence. Our intelligence says, I need Krishna's intelligence. And when Krishna sees that we recognize we need his intelligence, he gives it. The Dami Buddhi Yogam Tam. Tesham Evanukam Pratam. When he sees that we're consistently, so there has to be some, this is a free will thing, there has to be some, like, energizing of our free will towards Krishna. It's a free will exercise therapy. Just keep exercising free will toward Krishna. And let Krishna know, I hope you see this exercise because I need this higher intelligence. I need Bodhi Yoga. I need you to direct my intelligence, which can then direct my mind. And Krishna gradually take that position. It's not that you become like a zombie or something, a mindless robot. It's a toy in Krishna's hand. It just plays with you. You're fully present. Intelligence becomes most strong. Mind becomes most strong. It's not to do this, say it the other way around. To do this takes more strength, more clarity, more determination. It's not the position of weakness. It takes greater strength, greater determination, greater clarity than just, being a materialist. Letting the mind and senses rule. It takes much stronger intellect to come to that position. Discriminating capacity. And Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, one who studies the sacred conversation is worshipping me with his intelligence. So we're, with our intelligence, we want to receive what Krishna says with clarity. We want to know what he says and receive what he says. And be clear whether we want to accept it or not, because that follows after Krishna says, consider carefully, do what you feel you must do. Free will is chief. And if we say, Krishna, you take the steering wheel, he'll do it in a very loving way. It's not like, okay, back seat. Be quiet. That's not the relationship. It's a loving relationship. He'll hand us back the steering wheel.
you know, if we're at the steering wheel, we know where the signals are coming from. And we're happy to be like that. The false sense of independence or competing with Krishna is over in spiritual life. Could you speak a little
louder?
Which subject? Free will subject, yeah. We were.
The soul, when he uses the body, it gets mind, it
gets false. Well, the other way around. When the soul leaves the body, it's carried by the subtle body to the next gross body.
Still the mind and the limbs are false.
The other way around, yes. They carry the soul.
Okay.
All three.
The spiritual world, is that the mind still
yes.
exists?
The, well, in the spiritual world, before one reaches the spiritual world, the material mind dissolves. But there's a spiritual mind. Just like inside a glove, there's a hand. And the fingers wiggle because the fingers of the glove wiggle because the fingers are wiggling. To remove the hand, it just sits there. It doesn't wiggle. So, by according to what Kapila Dev teaches Devahuti, by the process of bhakti only, the material mind not only get relief, like this question of happiness, not only you get relief from the disturbing features the mind imposes upon us, the material mind dissolves. But the soul proper has thinking, feeling, willing. That's what moves the mind. It's what energizes the mind. And then the mind energizes matter. The mind says, I want something to eat. It's breakfast time. And so the body starts to go about the activity of getting breakfast ready. So, mind moves matter. The spirit soul has to be there to animate the mind. And when the soul, the consciousness of the soul becomes filled with spiritual happiness, this is what we read yesterday. The covering is removed. It's not just put over there and later you put it back on again. It's dissolved. So there's a spiritual mind and a spiritual intelligence and a spiritual sense of self.
Is the intelligence to exist in
the spiritual world? Yeah, the power of discrimination exists. It doesn't. It exists. I mentioned there's a conception of self. It's a material. False ego is a material element, and it's abandoned. You know, goes in the trash bin. It's discarded, but the sense of self is there. So, like the Vedas describe, aham brahmasmi. What's the sense of self? I am Brahman. But then, okay, what does Brahman do? As Brahman, what do I do? And a further detailed description of what the soul is I serve Krishna, dasasmi. I'm the servant of the Supreme. That's what I do. That's the sense of self. That's ego. Who am I? I'm the eternal servant of Krishna. That's who I am. That's what I do. And then there's varieties of service, and there's varieties of rasas in the realm of who I am.
So that means that the false ego does not exist.
That means the false ego does not exist in the spiritual world, but real ego exists. Mother Jasoda understands, Krishna is my son. Balarama understands, he's my brother. That's the sense of self. True ego. The blades of grass are, I'm here for Krishna's walking on. And the cows to eat. That's who I am. So, the rules of the spiritual world are not the same rules of the material world. Because in the material world, somebody's somebody's mother or father, and then they're gone. And that relationship is gone. But these are relationships that are eternal. The eternal identity of the soul. Krishna's flute has a relationship with Krishna. Because everything in the spiritual world is conscious. And it gets really exciting. This, according to the Bhagavad Gita, this realm is a reflection of the spiritual realm. In this realm, everything is temporary. It's distorted. It's a distorted manifestation of the object that it's reflecting. And the reflecting surfaces the mind. How I see things and how you see things, the same thing, can be different depending upon the configuration of mind. And when the material mind is dissolved, the spiritual mind sees according to our rasa with Krishna. And that's eternal. But there's harmony between the rasas. It's not like, this rasa and that rasa clash. It's just varieties of love, all in harmony with the Supreme. So that's real ego. Real intelligence, real mind. This is but a reflection of that. To enter into the spiritual realm, this part is left behind. False ego doesn't get imported. There's a ban on importing false ego. An embargo. No false ego comes into this territory. To that question is dependent upon the choices that each of us make and mercy of Krishna. But the wish, the gift that Prabhupada would speak again and again is to go back to Godhead in this lifetime. Now, if it takes many lifetimes, that's okay. Whatever, from Krishna's side, whatever he wants, but from our side, the wish of our founder Acharya is, in this one lifetime, go for it. Qualify yourself, prepare yourself for this one lifetime. If you think multiple lifetimes, then chances are that's the direction it's going to go. If you're thinking one lifetime, then more likely it'll be less. So, what's that price that we have to pay to make that happen in this one lifetime? It's our full surrender to Krishna. say it in reverse, are letting go, are leaving behind mental speculation and sense gratification. So now this question about what's the alternative to mental speculation, that was Manoj's question. How do we get past the tendency of the mind to just speculate on anything and everything that we hear and don't hear and imagine? How do we shut that off? Go with get to the option of just receiving Krishna's guidance. So I spent some time discussing that. But it's how long depends upon the sincerity. Prabhupada uses the language of in proportion to our surrender. That determines how long. And the second question is, what about intermediate steps? Going to the heavenly planet, it's going to take too long, so I'll just go there for a while and then work my way. It doesn't happen like that. What Krishna describes in the 8th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, generally, is persons who go to the heavenly planet, Svargaloka, the tendency in Svargaloka is enjoy! Opulence! It's like, you know, going to Hawaii or going to Goa or something. And who goes to Hawaii or Goa for spiritual practice? They go for some other reason. But it's so delightful or whatever, you know, the mood is enjoy. We have heavenly opulence. Look at all this beauty. Look at all this wealth. Ooh, one becomes intoxicated with that. And then after Chine Punye Marcha Lokam Vishanti, after extending all one's punya, your account is empty. Come again to this plane and continue where you left off. So what's important is not, Krishna says to Arjuna, Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Purnar Arvartan Arjuna, one should not aspire for the highest planet up to Brahma Loka, down to the lowest planet, because therein repeated birth and death take place. One should aspire for, this is Krishna now, one should aspire for that place which has no birth and death. Not an intermediate place where I can get to the next place, to the next place. One should aspire for deathlessness, or the spiritual realm. That's Krishna's encouragement. So don't think to go in steps. The Bhagavatam describes that it's so advantageous compared to the whole universe. The demigods are aspiring to take birth in this realm because in the heavenly realm enjoyment is too much. In the hellish realm suffering is too much. Here is not too much enjoyment, not too much suffering. It's conducive for spiritual practice. Enough suffering that we know that, wait, I don't want to be here. But not so much suffering that we just crushed with suffering, like the hellish planets. So rather than think, if you want to think intermediate, let me take it some step that's a doable step. Let it be on the devotional plane, not destination of planet. So supposing Krishna addresses this question, supposing one in this life doesn't complete, then what? Krishna's answer is, well, there's two options. You can go to the heavenly planets, enjoy for a long time, expend your pious credits, come back and continue. Or you can right away take birth in a pious family. What's the verse? A wealthy aristocratic family or a Brahmana family, wealthy aristocratic in the sense that your necessities are taken care of and you don't have to worry about that. You don't have to get a job when you're 5 years old to help the family. You can have your spiritual education and training and continue. Or even better than that is to take birth in a family of devotees, those who are fully dedicating themselves to spiritual practice after this life. That's better than the heavenly planets. I didn't go the whole way, but now I can continue where I left off. Because heaven's not continue where we left off, it's enjoyment. That's the main program. It's part of the problem that Indra has. He gets so infatuated with enjoyment that he does like really bad things sometimes. And he's the king of heaven, which is speak of like a denizen in his kingdom.
Question comes up to mind is like suffering. Like this the human body right now. We're talking about hellish suffering. We don't have a comparison. I cannot compare it.
We have no imagination of what hellish suffering is like.
So if I'm saying I'm suffering now, is it me suffering or is my soul suffering?
It's the mind. My answer is coming from Krishna to Uddhava. The place where that sense of suffering is in the mind. On the soul level, the suffering is separation from Krishna. Because of separation from Krishna, I'm feeling not the happiness, just like this question this gentleman asked about happiness. I'm missing that happiness. That's suffering. So to get relief from that suffering, the cure is connecting with my real happiness. That's my relationship with Krishna. Like the question that your wife asked yesterday about Atmaram. She was saying, prior understanding is that Atmaram is you're satisfied within yourself. And my answer was, that's incomplete. Because happiness within oneself is in relationship with the Supreme. The complete sense of Atmaram is in relation with the Supreme. That's my happiness. On the soul level. And so, where is that suffering? What is the place of suffering? There's anywhere in the material condition, material, heavenly, anywhere, it's suffering. Because we've forgotten Krishna. That love of our life has been forgotten. That's suffering. And then there's varieties of that suffering, according to the modes of nature. Guna and karma, there's varieties of suffering. But what's the tablet? What's the one medicine? What's the one cure to take care of the whole thing? Guna and karma, gone. It's the awakening of our dormant Krishna consciousness. Our love for Krishna. One tablet takes care of the whole thing. Love for Krishna. And love for Krishna is manifested in varieties of service to Him. So that's where, like a laser, very focused attention should go to our love for Krishna. In the first evening during this visit, when the host of the program was asking, what are some of the measures that we should look at? His questions were, what are the five most important things that we can do to get that? To get our goal of life. I said it's actually one thing, is our love for Krishna. And all other things are connected to that. How is it helping our love for Krishna?
And we can't just, we should not just imagine, well, love for Krishna will be like this, and it'll feel like that, and it'll look like that. We have scripture that tells us, and we have sadhus that help us understand scripture, and we have spiritual master that helps us understand how to apply guru and sadhu, the guru and shastra, to our life. So we need those guiding features to help us achieve this goal of our loving exchange, our loving relationship with Krishna. That's the goal. That's our real happiness. And that happiness is so great, again, as this is right on topic, that happiness is so great that the other allures of bhakti, mukti, or siddhi pale, they fade completely, become literally unimportant, including the mind and the dictates of the mind. It's just unless we keep giving energy to the mind, keep feeding it. Here, you give importance to it. The mind says, "Oh, you're my dear companion. I have to listen to you. You're my best secretary." We hear another voice instead. Tune into the Krishna channel. "My dear mind, be quiet. I'm listening to Krishna." "Well, to what instrument are you going to listen to Krishna? You have to pass it through me first." The premise is good, but the reality is different than the premise. We have our dual agenda. One is what you just said, and the other is, I've got this independent spirit. That's what is part of the material condition. I want my own program. I want to enjoy on my terms. Why is it always Krishna?
That's the agenda of the mind.
That's happening, that's a free will program. That free will energizes, so here we're going back to the discussion yesterday. Where does it all start? What triggers this misuse of free will? It's a free will. It's this rebelliousness of the soul towards the Supreme that says, "I want this independent enjoyment." It's enviousness. Why him all the time? At least I should be some of the time. It's only fair. Him some of the time and me some of the time.
Where is that me coming from?
This is ego, and there's the misapplication of our free will. We have that inherent within the soul. But here's the issue. Krishna is the drop of water from the ocean has minerals and salt, etc., like the ocean, only it's very tiny. Or the spark onto the fires,
has qualities of fire, but it's very tiny. We have qualities like Krishna, which is very tiny. Krishna has unlimited free will, we have tiny free will. We have knowledge, Krishna has unlimited knowledge. We have happiness, Krishna has unlimited. We have qualities like Krishna in a tiny degree. So, on the free will category, we have tiny free will. We don't have unlimited free will, but we do have, intrinsic to the soul, free will. Because it's part of Krishna, who has unlimited free will. Because of the limited mass of this free will, we're tatasta, or marginal, we can properly or improperly use that free will. And what triggers it? It's our free will. Not something outside. It's not matter. It's not spirit, like, you know, the spiritual world. We're not forced to be with Krishna. We have this free will. We can say, And it's our free will that triggers whether we use it this way or that way. We make a choice, a free will choice that says yes or no. And if it's no, here we are. And if it's yes, it's the spiritual world. But I've been discussing this several times now. Our acharyas describe in our regaining of our healthy condition that says yes, we have this say yes and say no. We have this divided disposition. We want the spiritual world, but we want our independence also. We're just like, we're hung up on it. We're addicted to it. We're junkies. We can't do without it. It's like me. I'm independent. And I decide what happiness is, and I decide how I'm going to get that happiness, and Krishna, you better listen up. Because this is what I want. Don't you understand? Come on, get it together.
That's Krishna moving.
Well, no, it's not. No, it's not. No, because the difference is, here's the difference. The very nature, we've had this discussion before. I remember having this discussion with you before. This very discussion. I remember very distinctly. We went in fine detail. We went over this discussion. Krishna, it's not, there is a natural order of things. And why is there the natural order of things? Because Krishna is God. And He's loving. As we have propensity to love, it's because that's there in God unlimitedly. His propensity is unlimited love. And in that unlimited lovingness of Krishna, there's a natural order. He wants our happiness, but He won't interfere with our misuse of free will either. As this man was asking about, you know, how do we find happiness? Krishna wants that happiness for us. He wants that happiness for us. And the natural order of happiness is, yes, it's on His terms. Now, Krishna's nature is, He wants it to be on our terms. But that on our terms situation is when there's genuine love. Because He is the Supreme. There's a very nice section, read it, if you get the chance. When Durvasa Muni goes to Lord Vishnu, and says, the Sudarshan Chakra, help. And Lord Vishnu says, I can't help. I'm bound by the love of my devotee. I can't independently do anything for my devotee. Why? Because He's given Himself completely to me, and because He's done that, I've given myself completely to Him. I don't have any independence anymore.
Of course he has independence, but it's his loving nature. I can't do anything. You have to ask Raj Ambarish. And if he says, then it's okay. Anything can happen. Because I'm subservient to the will of my devotee. He's not. He's independent. But because of the love of such a pure devotee as Maharaj Ambarish, I'm not independent. Whatever he wants to do. But he is independent. By the fullness of his independence is, he places himself dependent. Like the love of Mother Jasoda.
Do you think it's too complicated in terms of...
It's love.
Meaning?
It's love.
Yeah, but then...
It's a reciprocation of one gives one's, the lover gives oneself fully to the beloved gives one's self to fully unto the lover.
The ultimate essence is that you love yourself rather than you love anyone.
No, the ultimate essence is Krishna is the lovable object. This is his nature. We can't set up rules like that.
No.
Krishna can.
I understand that, but what I mean to say is the ultimate essence. Krishna loves himself, so
but all there is Krishna. We're part and parcel of Krishna. Krishna loving us is loving himself.
Right.
Our loving Krishna is loving ourselves. A real self love, the ultimate of selfishness is love of Krishna.
Yeah. But then that is also not desirable.
That's desirable by a devotee. It's because it's not tainted by anything material. It's fully on the platform of love. It's the ultimate. So Mother Jasoda is not thinking, some persons want to become enjoyers. Some persons want to become one with God. I want to become greater than God. Let me become a nice devotee of Krishna and then I'll be greater than him. He'll run in fear of my stick. Then I'm greater than him. And I want to bind him and I won't be able to bind him. But because of my love for him, then I can bind him. She's not thinking like that. That's not wanted by a devotee. But how Mother Jasoda is thinking, that's wanted by a devotee. The devotee doesn't want to place Krishna subordinate to them. Arjuna doesn't want Krishna as his chariot driver. I can't wait till that day. I get my new car and Krishna comes and he's the chauffeur. He drives me around. I can't wait. The devotee says, but Arjuna is accepting that position because Krishna wants, therefore I accept. Krishna, take my chariot into the middle of the two soldiers' array and let us see who is lined up before the battle. So Krishna takes him, Parthasarathi. And it's not figurative, it's literal. With the figurative, it's Krishna becomes, takes the wheel. And we're the passenger. He's the chauffeur. And we're the dude. He's driving us around. Go left. Go right. Okay. But it's not like that. He's directing. He's the intelligence that's directing our life. That's always the case. So the intelligence of the intelligence of Mother Jasoda. Her friends, Mother Jasoda's friend, Jiva Goswami describes like this. The friends of Mother Jasoda saw, Mother Jasoda, don't you understand? You're not going to be able to bind Krishna. Just this morning you put a little string around his waist and tied a little ring on the string and it worked. But now you can't do it, so just resign yourself. It's not meant to be. You have all the ropes of all the householders and all the brush with, and how many ropes do we have? So many ropes. And it still won't go around Krishna's ways. Just accept it's not meant to happen.
That's the logic. The mother Jasoda doesn't go by logic. She knows he's my son. I have to do this. If he grows up and I haven't properly disciplined him, who knows what will happen? He could just be an unruly person that I'll have failed in my motherly responsibilities. I must. And as she was perspiring and the flowers were falling from her hair, and Krishna saw what anxiety she was in. But her motivation is not, let me control Krishna. It's her motherly affection. It's rasa. It's a different set of rules. It's the rule of love. So your statement was, isn't this too complex? That's the life of simplicity. This is the life of complexity. We're always calculating something. Mother Jasoda is not thinking what's in it for me. It's all out of love. And the gopis are thinking, and the coward boys are thinking, and the cows are thinking. And that's the paradox is that that's their best self-interest. It's their real self-interest. And their best self-interest is the maximum selfishness. But the thought is not selfishness. The thought is Krishna, serving Krishna. It gets even more enigmatic with Krishna's relationships in Vrindavan. Like the one that you became confused about when you visited in Ravel. Not Ravel. Place where Mother, Abhimanyu and Radharani's place. So, it's a rule of love, not a rule of reason. It defies reason. By reason, why would one love another in like that? How is that love? Chasing after Krishna with a stick. Or Jatila and Katila intervening in the meeting of Radha and Krishna. There was service because it enhanced the excitement of the meeting of lover and beloved.
Yes.
it defies reason. It's another set of rules. It's the rule of love. That which is pleasing to Krishna. So we're way back over here where we're just struggling with our mind and senses. But that's the principle that we need to move forward by. Look to, as within our capacity and with the help of those who are guiding us in spiritual life and our dear friends, spiritual friendships, how to make our life, what we're doing now, more that which is directly pleasing to Krishna. How do I connect my desire and my psychophysical nature, how do I connect that best to Krishna, Krishna's happiness? That's our present challenge. I think we'll end. Thank you very much.
Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. His Holiness Srila Prabhupada Maharaj Ki Jai.